British Columbia. I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies. Watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger. You'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is April 4th, 2019, and this is episode 132. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast. And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're going to get into some nitty-gritty procedural issues in the BC legislature and, of course, Trudeau's feelings about secret recordings. Spoiler alert, he's against them. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca.
Members, there is a tie, and on conscience, I am voting for the motion. I support the motion.
First up, John Horgan lost his first vote this week. The NDP's track record in the legislature has been what you would expect of an overwhelming majority government, because they've managed to keep every one of their MLAs in their seats at every time. And this week in the committee hearings over the LNG bill, I think it's Bill 10 that's going through the legislature, it went down to a tie, and ultimately the speaker sided with the Liberals, and so an amendment from the BC Liberals passed, and the Horgan NDP was left with egg on their face. It's worth breaking this down procedurally, because even though the amendment itself isn't that consequential and the LNG bill will still pass, this could have ramifications for the long-term functioning of our democracy here in British Columbia. So first, let's talk about this amendment, I guess, just to explain what it is. Did you read up on it?
So this was an amendment the Liberals introduced that would have basically cut out the line in the NDP's bill that repealed a Liberal law that required the government to disclose the details of any LNG deal they work out, which actually seems like a pretty reasonable proposal, and it's a little weird the NDP wanted to get rid of it.
Yeah, I don't know what the thinking was there. The NDP said, no, we are in favor of transparency, because to be clear, the end result of this amendment passing is that the law stays as it was, where the government has to disclose any big LNG projects publicly. Good thing. We both like that. Transparency.
NDP apparently don't, because they tried to strip it out.
Yeah, they had said that they had already posted the LNG Canada deal, but doing it but not being required to suggests maybe the companies wanted to keep things secret, or maybe in the future they wanted to keep it secret. But yeah, I am in favor of the transparency aspect. One group that wasn't necessarily in favor, or it was unclear, was the Greens. When this amendment came to a vote, the Greens called for division. So they asked for the speaker to do a counted vote, and they promptly, the entire Green caucus left the chamber, because I guess if you're in the House for a divided vote, division vote, you have to vote yay or nay. And the Greens, hating LNG and probably in favor of transparency, but not wanting to vote for anything that might indicate some support for this bill?
I feel like that's really too inside baseball. Like, nobody further than 100 meters from the legislature could possibly care about the outcome of that vote when deciding how they in turn will vote.
Or maybe they just didn't want to vote with the Liberals on this. I don't fully understand their thinking, but they left. And so that left 41 New Democrats in the House and 41 Liberals plus the Deputy Speaker, because the main Speaker, Darrell Plekis, doesn't sit in on committee meetings for reasons. So the vote goes and it becomes a tie. And as we discussed last summer, ties are complicated in the legislature, because the speaker is supposed to have a precedent where they vote with the government, essentially, or vote to keep things going.
Yeah, they vote to continue debate and preserve the status quo on final reading. So, and in this case, that the operative precedent is that in a tie on an amendment, the bill itself should remain unchanged, i.e. the status quo should be what prevails.
Yeah, so siding with the NDP to defeat the Liberal amendment. So Deputy Speaker Joan Isaac, who is with the BC Liberals, says when it comes to her, on conscience, I am voting for the motion, which in most cases seems fair because most MLAs should vote their conscience, we would hope. But like we just said, the speaker holds this chair position. And I'll give a lot of credit for Von Palmer breaking down why this procedural minutia matters in his column for The Sun, where he points out the UK speaker, John Bercow, who we've talked up before on this podcast, apparently recently had to break the first tie in like 3 decades in the UK Parliament on one of the random Brexit votes.
Order, in accordance with precedent and on the principle that important decisions should not be taken except by a majority, I cast my vote with the noes.
Yeah.
So the noes have it. The noes have it. By casting vote 311 to 310. That is the proper way in which to proceed. The rationale, I say this as much for the benefit of new members as of others, for the exercise of the casting vote is, as I've said, that it is not for the chair to create a majority that doesn't otherwise exist. Now, the way in which the casting vote is exercised does also depend upon the stage at which a matter is being aired. So, for example, it would be exercised differently, or it could be, and probably would be, on the second reading of the bill, where there is an important principle of encouraging further debate, and it might then be used to send a bill into committee where it's not going to get to the statute book straight away. But if it's the final stage of a bill, the casting vote would be against. And in a situation in which a decision would be made that a day would be allocated for particular business, I judge that it's not right for me to make that decision if the House hasn't by a clear majority done so. I hope that's clear and generally acceptable.
In essence, there wasn't a majority in the UK for that amendment to go through. And in this case, the majority didn't, of the House that was there, didn't support this amendment unless the Speaker cheats, sort of. Palmer ends his column with this telling line, but by scorning earlier precedents, the Liberals have created a new one, which could be used against them at other times by other chairs. Basically hinting that with this tight legislature, if we have some MLAs who are sick or not able to be in the legislature, or maybe they've resigned, and the main vote, like a confidence vote, comes down to a tie, then Daryl Plekis may be making a far more conscience-driven vote than would have otherwise been assumed.
I'm not sure Daryl Plekis is going to go off just because this one committee vote went in a way that isn't consistent with precedent, but it's not great either. And circling back, like, the fact that this is the first time they've actually had that unbalanced situation is a little surprising, just considering how narrow the margin is.
And how much time people spent the summer of 2017 talking about, you know, how will this whole speaker question, it was like 2 months of how will that work out. And it turns out just fine, because you had Daryl Plekis scorning his political party and them scorning him back. So we'll have to see where this goes and if this comes up again. Maybe this is just going to be a footnote of a footnote in history, because ties don't actually come up that much. And if the BC Greens show up to vote, or the Liberals don't all show up to vote, as they've somewhat been wont to do, then it won't be an issue again. But one thing that might be a bigger issue for the Liberals than the NDP wielding the conscience of a deputy speaker who might be more favorable to them is the fact they're broke.
Yeah, so earlier this week, the party's financial disclosures were released. Patrick from the Canby Report went through this and put together a little blog post for us on our website, which we'll link in the show notes. I encourage everyone to check out. But I think the headline here is that the Liberals are not in great financial shape. So they took in a good chunk of money, but the problem is they have quite a bit of debt, which brings their total assets minus liabilities down to a mere $250,000.
That's compared to the $5.2 million the New Democrats are sitting on and the $1 million that the BC Greens are sitting on, which is probably the healthiest they've ever been in their history as a party. Don't quote me. The Liberals seem to be really struggling to make up these debts that they have. Like you said, their fundraising isn't so far behind the BC NDP, and they're both getting, I think it's about $800,000 on this per vote subsidy that the NDP introduced to help each of the political parties get off of corporate and union donations. But the Liberals are sitting on a massive loan, which was possibly used to fund the full amount that they spent on the electoral reform referendum. And they also have a very large staff to fund. So what will that mean, especially if the chatter in Victoria that Wilkinson may not be the most preferred leader of the caucus there? What will that mean for them going forward?
I mean, they're in a great spot to fight an election, and they really do need to do quite a bit of work to get their financial house in order. The immediate speculation was, oh, will this mean an early election for the NDP to capitalize on? I don't think that's likely.
Like, they have the money to do it. They have, and this is one of the few times in history that the NDP has been well ahead of the Liberals on fundraising and cash in the bank. But elections are still risky. You can win an election without having the most money. Money doesn't always count for everything. Now, we've seen that happen before with parties that spend less still winning. That happened in the electoral reform referendum. The other story here is that the Greens actually are sitting in a pretty healthy place. They're starting to really have enough money to build out assets like computers and staff and really become a true political party, like an apparatus, an institution. They're in a tough spot because they probably wield the most power they could in any situation. Like, even if they doubled their caucus, if it's suddenly an NDP or Liberal majority government, they might have more staff and more resources, but then no power. So the calculus for them is pretty tough.
Yeah, I don't think the Greens want an election any time sooner than they have to, precisely for that reason. They are likely to hold their three seats on the islands. So in that sense, they're, I think, fairly safe, but they probably won't have the pull after the next election. So they don't really have any incentive to do it. The Liberals don't. And even the NDP, like, they're getting on fine. They're not having much trouble passing their bills, despite being a somewhat narrow margin. So overall, like, do they want to roll the dice here? I mean, it might help them, but, you know, if Wilkinson really is this big of a drag on the party, is getting basically kicked out for losing an election sooner rather than later going to help them, rather than waiting out the 4 years and then doing it then? Maybe not.
Yeah, I agree.
Hello.
Hello, Michael. It's Jody.
Moving on, segment two. There's no infighting in the Liberal Party of Canada. It was another eventful week in the ongoing SNC-Lavalin scandal, kerfuffle, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, at the end of last week, I think we had known when we recorded that Jody Wilson-Raybould was submitting evidence to the Justice Committee and that it would be coming out. And I think we had just heard that that included an audio recording, and that came out. But almost everyone has forgotten about that by now, because now she's also out of caucus. But let's talk about the recording first. So she puts up this 17-minute tape of her talking with Michael Wernick, the clerk of the Privy Council office, the former top bureaucrat.
I think he's still there.
He's still technically.
He's announced he's leaving, but he still has the job.
The guy who's on the way out. And it's them talking about SNC, her talking about the pressure she's feeling from the Prime Minister's office and everyone around him to give a deferred prosecution agreement, this deal to SNC, and how she thinks that's inappropriate, unconstitutional, and him just saying, just use the tools that are in the toolbox. That's why we put it in the bill. Everyone knows that. Let's just get Bev McLaughlin on the phone.
The interesting part to the just get Bev McLaughlin on the phone was Wilson-Raybould's response of,
I'll call Beverly McLaughlin. I can't even imagine her feeling in any way, shape, or form comfortable with interfering with the independent prosecutor.
So the conversation's worth listening to in full if you have a spare 15, 20 minutes. Makes for great content.
It's 17 minutes total. Yeah, it's, I think, illuminating in a few different ways. There's quite a few like interesting tidbits in there. One of them was that apparently the Prime Minister's office got a copy of the Section 13 note, the note that the prosecutor prepares and sends up to the Attorney General letting them know what's going on when there's a matter of general interest.
But he was apparently wanting to claim it was lost in the mail or something, you know, buried in email or they just lost these confidential documents.
But what was also quite interesting is that she was really insistent that she's protecting the prime minister in all of this. And there's an interesting exchange where Warnich effectively says he doesn't see it that way. And to which the response is, well, that's because nobody's told him.
So we
I don't think he sees it as that. I mean,
well, then nobody's explaining that to him, Michael.
And his subsequent claim is that despite her emphasizing, well, you or someone should tell him and talk to him, or I'll even talk to him, is that after this phone call was held, he just, I guess, went on Christmas break and no one talked to him in over the couple weeks about this?
That's the claim, is that despite this being a top priority, and weren't repeating it several times that this is a top priority, apparently didn't bother following up with his boss about his boss's high priority thing, and that they never spoke again on the issue until after Jody Wilson-Raybould was shuffled out. Which strains credibility, to say the least.
Yeah, so the other side of this and the other narrative that's being thrown out, and we'll dig into this more as we see Trudeau's response, is all these different partisan hacks and others questioning, you know, why is the Attorney General recording phone calls with the top bureaucrat? And the related question to that is, if you go, was she recording it just to smear them? Was she then playing it up in the phone call? Like, because when you know you're being recorded, as we are being recorded right now, it turns out...
What?
You perform. And I think her interview in McLean's, which came out yesterday or today, her response is, the point here isn't about the recording. I didn't want to release that, but people kept lying about everything I had said with them. So I felt this was an extraordinary situation. And I recorded because I was at home and didn't have someone there to sit and take notes to give an impartial observation on it.
The outrage of the recording seemed a little forced or opportunistic. Just to skip ahead a bit, the following Tuesday, I think it was, Jill Butts put more testimony to in or submitted more written testimony to the Justice Committee, which was released that day. And there's verbatim transcripts in that nobody seemed too upset about. So there does seem to be a bit of a double standard at work here.
Everyone's taping everyone. I guess that does speak to an erosion of trust, because you don't tend to tape everyone if you're all feeling really good about your relationships. But I think you're right that it does feel forced, and I do side with Jody Wilson-Raybould here that focusing on the tapings themselves misses the broader question that isn't resolved by the fact, you know, even if you accept that she shouldn't have taped them, that's relatively minor compared to the PMO and Privy Council Office applying this pressure on the Attorney General.
Because that's the core thing, is we still haven't gotten resolution on the core problem here, which is, should the Prime Minister and the nonpartisan head of the civil service be applying pressure to the Attorney General to interfere in a criminal prosecution?
Jobs. So Trudeau wasn't happy about this. He decides to have a caucus meeting to discuss the fate of Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott. And one of the first things that came out that morning was he's going to recuse himself from the caucus meeting so they can discuss freely. I'm sure that was the freest conversation.
Just like the Justice Committee was entirely free to do what they wanted.
I mean, that one was at least publicly taped, so they could be held responsible for everything they said. But I think Trudeau has enough strong allies, I'm assuming, in caucus and cabinet, who will report who the snitches were if anything happens in that caucus. So caucus votes to expel...
Well, there's, I believe, actually some controversy on whether they did vote or whether, you know, they had the meeting, but Trudeau just made the decision himself and informed.
That's true. He didn't say what decision came out of there. He just said,
Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott are no longer members of the Liberal caucus. The trust that previously existed between these two individuals and our team has been broken. Whether it's taping conversations without consent or repeatedly expressing a lack of confidence in our government and in me personally as leader, it's become clear that Ms. Wilson-Raybould and Dr. Philpott can no longer remain part of our Liberal team.
There's also a lingering question here on whether the Liberal caucus actually followed the law with this. So near the end of the last government, the Reform Act passed in a significantly watered down version. This was Michael Chong's Let's Fix How Parliament Works Act. And one of the provisions that did make it through was that at the start of each parliament session, I forget the caucus needed to basically take a recorded vote on whether or not they would basically be following certain provisions of this act. And one of those provisions is the how requirements to expel caucus members. So nobody seems to have done that recorded vote, as well as there doesn't seem to have been the threshold required of caucus members saying we want to vote on expelling someone here. So that's an open question.
It's one of those...
like, it's very inside baseball, but at the same time, like, it's not good when people are just being thrown out of caucus, potentially in violation of the law.
Sure. And I just have to wonder, though, like, what's the recourse within the Reform Act? Because one of the biggest issues with regulating political parties' operations, especially caucus...
courts are really reluctant to weigh in on that.
The courts aren't going to do it because it's not their job. They deal with outside of parliament. Inside parliament, do what you want. The other parties don't have a stake in it. They'd rather you die in infighting. And so
they also don't have the votes to trigger anything in the House's internal procedures.
So I guess it's more of one of those symbolic laws. But procedural question marks aside, Trudeau comes out and does a speech to his caucus with the media in the back, basically announcing that they've been removed from caucus. And from there, it just goes downhill. His reasoning was he talks about how upset he is that she's making secret recordings, that they're declaring no confidence in the government. And if you're doing those things and saying those things, you can't really sit in caucus anymore. You can't be part of the team if you're not going to be a team player.
Yeah, so that's the line, but it's a uniquely Canadian take on the role of caucus, which in most parliamentary democracy, or at least most Westminster democracies, I'm not going to pretend to know how the Parliament of Slovakia works or something, but yeah, in most Westminster democracies, caucus isn't just an arm of the leader.
Well, we just have to look at the UK right now, how many broken votes the Conservatives there are having.
Yeah, that Boris Johnson resigned from his cabinet position, but he's still in caucus. Jeremy Corbyn, when he was an MP in the Blair government, like led protests against the Blair's government's war in Iraq. He remained in caucus. Like, it's in Australia, like caucus just likes to kick out their leaders just as a matter of course, it seems like.
They do have more ability to do that.
Yes, they do. But the point here is that caucus is its own body and not merely just bunch of people there to do what the leader says.
But Scott, the Liberal Party, as you'll remember, has been historically known for how much infighting it's done. And that infighting led them to such a period in the wilderness. And Justin Trudeau, if you'll remember his leadership campaign, he ran on ending the infighting, apparently. And now he's done that by kicking out the people who are trying to start fights.
Actually, speaking of caucus people who didn't get kicked out of caucus, Paul Martin didn't get kicked out of caucus, and the entire country knew he was trying to backstab the Prime Minister.
Well, and I think that's Trudeau's point. And look what happened. The Liberals lost power several years later for over a decade.
Yeah, several years later because of a massive scandal.
But it was also the infighting.
And I'm starting to think they maybe didn't spend enough time in the wilderness. Like, putting aside your views on the people who were there between the two Liberal governments, a lot of the bad habits seem to have stuck around even after a decade.
Well, and so let's come back to his reasoning. So he's upset about the tape phone call, and maybe that's grounds because it shows a complete lack of trust of that member with the government. The grounds for kicking Jane Philpott out seem far more tenuous, as a lot of people have pointed out.
He didn't really give grounds. He talked a lot about Jody Wilson-Raybould, barely mentioned Jane Philpott besides including her in the people who are no longer in caucus list.
So the thing she has done is she released her letter resigning from cabinet, and that was a scathing letter. Let's not pretend it wasn't. She did talk about how little confidence she had. And I forget the exact term. I think it was in the government or in the cabinet. And so she couldn't sit at that table. And maybe she's also given some extra leaks to the media or otherwise made a few statements, like the interview she did with McLean's where she said there's more to come, and that was it. So she has strayed outside the you're a good party member box, but...
Well, once again, like, in most places that don't have this really tight leader-driven party structure, there's enough room in most other Westminster parties, not in Canada, to have that modest level of disagreement. And like everything, every media thing she's done since being kicked out was basically, yeah, I'm pretty much still on board with like 99% of the Liberal Party's actions, goals, values, all that. It's just this one trying to undermine our justice system thing I have a slight problem with.
And I didn't like the approach that was being taken to essentially stab Jody Wilson-Raybould in the back repeatedly to try to discredit her and all of that. The final line Trudeau trots out to try to defend himself, because he doesn't even really talk about the SNC scandal or the deferred prosecution agreement.
Well, no, they've been trying to avoid talking about the core problem of, well, undermining the judicial system.
So his final line is to bring up the scary Andrew Scheer government that will happen if we don't all fall in line with the Liberals, and then there'll be no carbon plan, and I don't know, Nazis will be marching in the streets again because the alt-right. I mean, he didn't say the latter part, but it was heavy on the fear part.
All the surrogates have been basically saying it instead, and I believe like five Heather Mallett columns. It's a talking point that drives me up the wall. It's entirely reasonable to be angry at a government for crossing a very major constitutional line, and, you know, they shouldn't get a pass on that because another leader isn't great. Not only are there just more than two parties in Canada, there should absolutely be electoral consequences for that sort of action. Also, like, ultimately, like, it's good the Liberal government wants to do action on global warming. Ultimately, what happens between 2019 and 2023 in Canada, it's not going to have a huge effect on global temperatures. Like, I generally don't like the, well, who cares, we're a small country, but balancing off first rule of law sort of things, like, it's grand scheme of things, it's not necessarily a reason not to hold the government to account.
And it's possibly worth pointing out that I think most scientists and people who've looked at the policies the Liberals are rolling out, and I think maybe even the Liberals have admitted that the actions they're taking aren't sufficient to meet our climate objectives under the Paris agreements, and therefore we're still contributing to cooking the world. And that's not even getting into the specifics of how Trudeau wants to keep global emissions down while also supporting the expansion of pipelines all over the place. Or not all over the place, just
yeah,
to
it's a Vancouver. Weak argument I think yeah. We can both agree on.
He's been better than the previous government on the environment, but that was a low bar, and he's not good enough.
And like he definitely deserves props for bringing in the like national carbon pricing, which did take effect this week, as apparently every conservative politician in the country decided to do on-site gas price reporting.
It's the first time most of them have filled up their pump, as I saw one person joke on Twitter.
I think they mostly pump their own gas. Yeah.
So that's the run-through of Trudeau's lines. Following this news that they're out of caucus, it comes out that there had been a number of MPs who'd been trying to negotiate a truce in this situation, including Burnaby's own Terry Beach, who gave an interview with the Burnaby Now, which kind of read like, hey, I was just trying to help everyone get along. I was, you know, putting meetings together without any proof beyond his word. And I'm not saying he wasn't there or setting up meetings, but it really felt like him trying to get himself into the story. But who knows? I do believe there were efforts to get them to meet. And the leaks that came out were that Jody Wilson-Raybould and Jane Philpott had a list of demands for Trudeau that would have smoothed everything over. Well, maybe not everything, but at least there's been five, a pathway.
Yeah. There was five things they wanted. to have happen. They wanted the Prime Minister to fire Jerry Butts, Michael Warnant, and Matthew Bouchard, whose name has come up several times. He's one of the PMO staffers who was identified as putting a lot of pressure on, I believe, various subordinates of Jody Wilson-Raybould. It might have meant...
I don't know if there was a meeting. I'd have to go back to the report notes, but yeah.
Heavily involved in the pressure campaign.
Now, Butts and Wernick have both announced their resignation since, and this not actually, because the PMO asked them to, necessarily.
Well, this actually shed some light on, potentially, on Jerry Butts, who, if you remember, had this really weird resignation letter where he talked about how he was proven to be a distraction, but he did nothing wrong, but I'm a distraction, so I need to leave. But trust me, I did nothing wrong here, which we remarked at the time was odd, and this was trying to smooth things out. Because everything he did since then only roughened things. There's also an assurance that David Lametti would not order the Public Prosecution Service to give a DPA to SNC-Lavalin.
Essentially just wanting to make sure that all of the work that Wilson-Raybould had done resisting the pressure wasn't just undone by the new guy.
Yeah, so I've seen kind of two takes on this. One is that, or at least one that's going through the media, is that this is somehow Jody Wilson-Raybould trying to effectively set terms on what the Attorney General could do and limit their independence, which is not how I had read it and not what I would have guessed, but several prominent commentators have taken that approach. I read it much more as a, you know, promise you're not going to do the same interference campaign you did to me, which is the much more parsimonious explanation here than 2 months of fighting about this only to reverse on this matter of principle that she'd stood firmly on. So that was a little weird. And there's some reports that that had gotten dropped off as talks had proceeded, but all of this is anonymous sourcing, so who really knows? And the final demand was that, or request, was that Trudeau admit that it was inappropriate pressure and apologize.
Either publicly or at least to caucus. But
seems reasonable,
way,
yeah. And I think we've said on the podcast, I definitely said on Twitter, if not on the podcast, that like if he'd actually just done that in the first week of February, we would not be talking about this now. Jane Philpott would still be in cabinet. We'd be talking about what the budget means. Hey, remember that happened?
No.
Exactly. You know, if he'd done I was really focused on the jobs, but like I was a little too enthusiastic about it. May have stepped over a line. Realized I was wrong here. We're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. We're going to strengthen the independence of the prosecution service. Whoops. Okay, let's all move on. We pretty much all would have. Like, it would have been embarrassing. You might have taken a momentary hit in the polls. There might be a couple of attack ads come October, but nothing like the sustained damage this has done.
Yeah, so this 5-point deal, which no one has confirmed was offered, but seems pretty well-sourced and no one's saying that didn't happen.
The Ottawa media establishment seems pretty confident in this. Take it as for what you will on there.
If that had gone through, obviously we'd be in a much quieter, better place for the Liberals. By contrast, I feel like we've continually gone down the, at every point in the decision tree, what is the worst way the Liberals can go? They keep choosing that. Like, a lot of people were very critical that, you know, they can't kick these two out because that look how bad that will look. And then they did. And not only did they do it, they did it in like the most sanctimonious,
ham-fisted way.
Yeah,
that's one thing I didn't mention is like Trudeau came off very smarmy in his press conference.
He started getting angry when he talked about the recordings, like he was personally attacked. And we've seen that come through a few times. Like we talked about I think it was last week with the Indigenous protesters at the Laurier Club.
That one he did apologize for.
He did apologize for that one.
So, you know, I guess good apology there, but like this also needed an apology. As we've talked about where all those decision trees have done, the media conversation has gone quite far away from what the core issue is here. And part of that is, you know, this development, so you talk about it, but it also seems like people are being far too focused on hyper-analyzing, you know, individual steps in this rather than, you know, whether or not it was right to record rather than whether or not it's right to interfere in the judicial system.
So rather than look at what they should do, I'm going to start thinking about what they're probably going to do by just thinking about the opposite.
Yeah, what's the worst possible next step they can do?
Grant the DPA.
Oh, yeah.
Or Lametti can issue the Gazette step.
Yeah, he said
that
he's still
to.
Thinking about it and reviewing it. Which, the fact that they just haven't come out and said no really shows their how out of touch they are in this.
The jobs. So, look for that probably in the next couple weeks, based on how things are going.
It's actually kind of like if someone had set out to systematically destroy the Trudeau brand, this is the play they would have run on.
Other than that, I can just see like a few more anonymous leaks trying to besmirch the two ousted liberals.
There's still some like outstanding questions here. Like we don't know why or how the PMO staffers knew the internal workings of the Public Prosecution Service. As well as there's several other kind of outstanding questions here, such as what had happened after the cabinet shuffle and the conversations between Philpott, Wilson Raybould, and the Prime Minister and his staff. So, I mean, those are important questions that, you know, Canadians should know about, and it'll be interesting to see if they also leak out and how the Liberals manage to do it in the most ham-fisted way.
The last question to touch on here is what next for Philpott and Wilson Raybould?
They're both still deciding their next move.
And I think most relevant for us is Jody Wilson-Raybould, she's a local MP for Vancouver Granville. Seems like she's pretty popular around here about now, because especially now that she's independent, you have people who are conservative who can like her for being full of integrity. You can have people who are New Democrats who support her for the same reason. She's strong on Indigenous and reconciliation issues. And even if you weren't a fan of her performance as justice minister like myself, you can now be like, well, she's not justice minister anymore anyway, so no worries there. So a lot of people are talking about her possibility of running as an independent being pretty strong and being one of those cases where she could actually win.
Yeah, if you're not a liberal partisan, she's come out looking fairly good out of this.
The only problem is if you win as an independent, you sit in the back corner with Elizabeth May. And no offense to Elizabeth May, and Maxime Bernier.
Yeah, you have to share a seat with Maxime Bernier, which...
And I think Aaron Weir.
Oh, yeah, he's back there, too.
And I guess, there are a number of other independents now. Someone posted a picture of all the independents because Tony Clement is independent these days because of the dick pic scandal.
He will not be seeking re-election.
He is not. You have a couple other liberals who got caught up in Me Too-type scandals.
The two out of Alberta, which is like half their Alberta caucus. There's also...
And Selena Caesar-Chavanez.
Yes.
So there's like this growing diverse caucus of misfits and people with allegations against them that she can hang out with. And even if you're elected as an independent, you don't have much of a voice in parliament.
Although there's a decent chance it's going to be minority parliament, so that could be interesting.
The other talk is whether she gets approached by one of the other parties. I think Elizabeth May gave a press conference where she said, either would be welcome to join the Green Caucus, which...
That's the standard green line for anything.
Yeah. Like everyone's welcome in the Green Caucus.
Well, I don't think she said that with Bernier, but...
Yeah.
For the most part, they're pretty open about we'll take anyone. They need the candidates.
I've heard rumors that Scheer and the Conservatives are trying to meet with Jody Wilson-Raybould, and I think she might be socially on justice issues a little bit closer to them than the NDP.
It's not entirely surprising for prosecutors that they may lean a little more that way.
I don't know. Maybe she could rewrite their reconciliation policy for them, or Indigenous issues policy. I imagine the NDP would want to pick her up as well, but you know where she ends up is undecided. And same, I guess, holds true for Jane Philpott, who again would be a very good pick up for anyone because of how well regarded she was in basically everyone who followed her career as a minister.
Mm-hmm. So Vancouver Granville was competitive in the last election. The Liberals ended up winning it by a decent margin, but it was definitely one of those competitive races. So much so that the strategic voting groups made the wrong call and suggested voting for the NDP there, which kind of goes to show why those groups are not great at their job. Because riding level polling is very hard. But regardless, it's a potentially competitive riding, particularly as the Liberals have made some decisions, such as buying pipelines, that aren't super popular in Vancouver. So already it was going to be an interesting election here. And if you have her running as well, pretty much any party, it was a good chance she gets reelected. And if she's an independent, well, that just puts the whole thing as a giant toss-up.
So that'll be fun to watch. Moving on to quick takes, we have a bit of an update on the hashtag Right to Bear Arms, the campaign led by the women of the press gallery, including BC Today's own Shannon Waters.
Not to walk around with guns in the legislature.
To walk around with literal no sleeves. They won. They won everything. Daryl Plekis released a follow-up statement. We widely mocked his letter that came out last week, and a lot of people found it very bizarre because it talked about how there shouldn't be gendered dress code, but also here's the gendered dress codes that exist that include all of this. And so he says in his new statement, "Sorry about that last one and any confusion it caused. I was just trying to outline the rules as I understood them, and they, quote, were in no way an endorsement by me." The acting clerk, he says, has completed an initial review of the dress code of the legislature, and he endorses the three recommendations. The first is that it be principle-driven and not overly prescriptive. So people are adults. They will figure out what professional dress codes mean and get along with that. The second point of the recommendations is that for women, business attire includes a range of contemporary conventional options, which may include sleeveless dresses, sleeveless shirts and blouses. For men, jackets, collared shirts, ties continue to be expected.
Which seems a little prescriptive for a, this is going to be a principles-based dress code.
There are examples, there are ranges. I know, it's not perfect. And this is preliminary. And finally, and this is the key one, the assembly dress guidelines will not be a responsibility of the sergeant at arms or other assembly staff to enforce. Each individual is capable of choosing appropriate professional business attire. In other words, there's no more fashion police wandering around the legislature telling you to put a slip in your dress because it's sticking to your legs, which is a thing that apparently happened. So good win. Huge credit to Daryl Plekis. This letter was actually, I think, much more on the mark than the last one. And it kind of helps move this whole chapter behind us. But yeah, big credit to everyone in the legislature who protested this, who made it an issue, and everyone who supported them, which seemed like the overwhelming majority of MLAs, press gallery members, and other staff. So just maybe it'll be the last time we have to talk about what people wear in the legislature, but given how society seems, I doubt it.
Well, moving on to another news item out of Victoria. Andrew Leavers asked the government watchdogs to investigate some ads from the NDP. So as you may or may not remember, partisan advertising with government dollars has been a long-standing complaint that basically gets leveled at every government, it seems like, and well, it's the NDP's turn.
So there's a series of ads running on the radio, and I've heard them a couple times when driving, and they are real partisan. They basically talk about how Andrew Wilkinson is only out there for the 1%, but the NDP are here to make sure life is more affordable for you. Thank you, John Horgan, paid for by the New Democrat Caucus, or the BC New Democrat Caucus. And it's that last little bit there that's telling, because the caucus is different than the party. The party uses the money that members give them, or that I guess they get a bit from the government, but ignore that. The caucus is funded through LAMSI, the Legislative Assembly Management Committee, and the legislature itself. So it is legislative money. It's tax dollars being spent. Now, the BC Liberals or BC Greens, I guess, could use some of their caucus funds to run radio ads.
But that's not really what we wanted. It's just an escalating war of partisan ads. And I realize I misspoke at the top. Weaver wants a government watchdog for this. He's not referring it to that.
And that seems like the minimum we should be doing, like a good start. Like, I have no problem with the New Democratic Party or the Liberal Party or the Green Party running lots of ads.
The NDP can use their comfortable war chest to run those ads and not bill both of us for it.
Yeah. And it's really hypocritical given the NDP undoubtedly raked the Liberals over the coals for doing the same thing like 3 years ago.
Yeah, and like usually when there's partisan ads, it's look at this great thing we're doing that, you know, your Liberal or your New Democratic government is doing. Like, they're not attack ads. Like, that's way over. Like, The other ones are over the line, but that's way over the line.
Yeah, time to move past that. But turning to the federal New Democrats, their latest push is a full pharmacare plan that they've released months ahead of the federal election. And this is something that tactically I'm really happy to see. The federal NDP could easily be caught up talking about SNC and scandals and just continuing to be ignored because who cares what they have to say? Like even the Conservatives, the scandal's entirely about the Liberals, so let's just talk about them. And it gives us more time to, like, obviously they need to have a response to the scandal.
Also, like, when your enemy is busy setting themselves on fire, it's not the time to interrupt them.
Yeah. And the thing that I've seen successful with, for example, the Corbyn election campaign that helped boost them and the current...
He still lost. But...
That helped boost him. And what is doing well for the Democrats in the States is rather than focus on your enemy's corruption all of the time, is start talking about the big ideas of what you will do and start painting that picture from every one of the presidential candidates down to AOC. That's what they're doing. And so here's the federal NDP starting to talk about pharmacare. And it turns out pharmacare is not actually hard for the federal government to do. It literally just involves throwing money at a thing. So
it's more complicated than that. So like throwing money at the thing is kind of the core part of this. But there's also the want standards across it. They have something similar to the Canada Health Act, although slightly different, like allows co-pays and a few other things like that. But, you know, you still have to create that national standards framework and everything. So that's complicated. Like, you don't actually have to go out to talk to the drug companies and negotiate prices. That's kind of left to the...
So I'll break it down. The plan is, like you said, create a piece of legislation at the federal level, like the Canada Health Act, the Canada Pharmacare Act, which is basically the federal government will work with each of the provinces to give them money to run pharmacare, because healthcare is a provincial jurisdiction, so it's not up to the federal government to run it.
40% is it they're giving?
Yeah, the federal government will chip in 40%, and the plan says the provinces are already spending the equivalent of that 60% on their own drug coverage plans, which maybe some of them are. But that one raised a little flag in this plan. But yeah,
also like
getting the provinces on board is the problem of the weak link of this. But like, there's no way not to do that.
Yeah, you have a scenario where like I'm sure Jaden seemed to call up John Horgan and get things rolling. But you know, decent chance Jason Kenney's going to be the next premier of Alberta, and as well as Doug Ford
and Scott Moe.
Yeah, him too.
And Brian Pallister. Like realistically. For the federal government, it doesn't actually matter if they don't buy in. They just don't get the transfers then. Because the carrot and stick the federal government have is just money. And they say, if you want these billions of dollars, sign on to this pharmacare plan. So the federal government would create the Canada Pharmacare Act, I guess. They would run this through transfers contingent on universal coverage and participation in a national formulary, which is a word I've learned recently. It's essentially a list of approved drugs and an agency that runs it. So the Morneau budget that we jokingly dismissed did include creating this Canada Drug Agency, which will create this formulary. So the first step is already going to start to happen, and that will decide what drugs would be covered and start to do those negotiations. Like you said, the majority of drugs won't have co-pays, so everyone will get their generic drugs for free. But they do say that brand names, you might have a $5 copay. I think when I lived in the UK, it was something like all basic drugs were like £8.
Which seems reasonable. Like, there's a reason many countries with universal health care have copays there. Because, it helps moderate usage of the system and avoid overuse.
The NDP do cite some study when they talk about copays that introducing them does create a prohibitive barrier for some people. And so their justification is we want to make sure everyone can get it, even if they, and hopefully it won't be abused. I don't know how they prevent that. And then there would be insurance options if you want, I don't know, designer luxury drugs.
Yeah, which is also another divergence a bit from the Canada Health Act. Just the Canada Health Act basically prohibits insurance from covering anything that's covered by the state plan.
I guess it's a little different because you don't have, like, different kinds of surgery that could do the same thing. And it's getting weird because some provinces do have, like, private MRI clinics. So, but those are in debate anyway. We've talked about cost a couple times. The Parliamentary Budget Office pegs the cost of this at $23.7 billion to roll it out in 2020, which is actually the goal Singh puts down, is they form government in October 2019, if miracles happen, and within a year, by late 2020, they have pharmacare up and running. So they want to be fast and ambitious about this.
Which, yeah, it's ambitious, but that's also quite a significant amount of money. So, for example, I believe Department of National Defense is the largest single department in the federal government. They get roughly $18.5 billion, something like that. 18.66 billion. And the transfer payments that the federal government transfer, so that's roughly half the Canada Health transfer, which is itself $40.3 billion. That's more than the equalization, and it's more than the Canada Social transfer. So, well, this represents a significant additional line item in the federal budget.
Well, yeah, $23.7 billion in 2020, but then going forward, $10 billion per year. So it does scale back, but it is still a large expense. Their justification is Canadians are probably spending around $30 billion a year on drugs right now. So this will save the country money. It's just redistributing who's paying, which is socialism. My favorite part, though, is they do say how they will pay for this. They say, quote, "It will be covered by budgetary reallocations and the raising of some new revenues."
It's a little vague.
A little vague. But it suggests there's going to be a massive tax plan coming. Like a big one.
Or they'll run big deficits.
Or they're just killing the military. Or something.
Oh, like, hopefully not that.
Yeah. That'll put people out of work. So more to come on that for sure. Because you don't just say, yeah, we're going to start paying $10 billion a year and unicorns will pay for it. The last thing to mention is that there is, of course, a special deal for Quebec, because there always is. Part of that is because Quebec actually already has pharmacare, because, of course, they do. And so their negotiations would have to be slightly different. And it's a distinct nation within a nation, so they get treated specially on every deal. But that's the NDP's pharmacare plan. Realistically, if the Liberals roll one out, it has to be in the same range. You can't give everyone access to cheaper free drugs for significantly less money. And I'm excited. I want this to happen because it's expensive, but it's one of those things that fills out our healthcare system.
It doesn't really make sense that, like, this and, like,
eyesight
eye care
and dental.
And dental, like, aren't included. The patchworkness is weird. Like, I have my critiques of the Canada healthcare system, but, like, the patchworkness is, yeah, one of the things that does not do particularly well and could use expanding to cover.
And I think we can both agree having a national drug formulary that is responsible for deciding which drugs are evidence-based, which is mentioned in here, is a good thing.
Yeah, no homeopathy would be covered, which would be a good thing.
That's what it sounds like.
Well, moving from one healthcare story to another, Nova Scotia just became the first province in Canada to have an opt-out organ donor system. So here in BC, like most other provinces, we have a system where if you want to become an organ donor, you have to affirmatively say, yeah, take my organs when I'm dead. Nova Scotia's decided to do the opposite, where it's basically now presumed you agree to it, but you're given a chance to opt out if you want. And generally, these systems lead to a much higher rate. It's just kind of changing the order of operation. You have the exact same choices you did before, but just changing how that's formulated can lead to a significant increase in organ donation. So that's good.
Yeah. Humanist UK, a group that I was slightly involved in when I lived in the UK and still connect with based on my own work, is a big campaigner for this in England. And I think Wales has already moved there or is moving there. And the basic idea is just that. Let's get more people donating organs when they die so we save more lives. And the humanist approach to it is your body isn't sacred in any magical way. So if you can help save other people, good. Now, if you have objections to your body being cut up and put into other people after you die, write that down. Just let someone know, stamp it on a card, make it clear, fine. We We don't need everyone's body, but just having more options, because part of the problem with organ donation is even if you are an organ donor, that might get missed if you die and no one knows, or you haven't, like, it, that evidence isn't on you when you die because you die in an accident, or your organs may not be useful. So we need more people on the list, and I think this is a really simple and smart and good way to do it. So credit to the Stephen McNeil government for pushing this through. And it seems pretty widely supported. This is another one of those issues where I think, like assisted dying and others, most people actually support it. Just politicians are always weirdly reluctant to do it.
I'm actually not sure what the public opinion is. It's the sort of thing that makes behavioral economists really happy, but I don't know. People can also have some weirdness around opt-out versus opt-in programs, so it's hard to say without actual polling on it.
One thing that is very weird, though, is the logo of Ontario.
I thought you were going to say the Doug Ford government.
Well, that's been acting very bizarrely. So it was first announced that they are going to be changing the motto on license plates to say...
Is it open for,
open for business now?
Was, they put up a bunch of signs and they talked about putting that, I think, on the commercial plates and something else on the personal vehicle plates.
Instead of whatever the current motto is, like yours to discover?
Yes, I believe that's the current motto.
The logo of Ontario, though, is based on the Trillium flower, a three-leaf flower.
Which is their provincial flower.
With people standing in the middle of it, sort of like arms raised up, sort of facing each other. But it's been pointed out by everyone up to the Premier of Ontario that it looks like three guys in a hot tub.
It really does. We'll throw a link in the show notes on this one. But yeah, so now they want to get rid of the three people chilling in a hot tub logo with something else.
I thought it was ridiculous at first, and then I thought about it and went, you know what? I see it now. You can't unsee it. And
yeah,
so,
I had this point out to me quite a while ago. So, and yeah, it's all you can really see.
I know governments get a lot of shit for any money they spend on branding, but they can probably get it done for a reasonable amount. Just do it quickly. Just get something. It's really hard to brand a province, especially in a logo, but even just go back to the previous one. Which was just the three triangles of the Trillium.
Yeah, less stylized.
Like a discount dogwood.
Yeah, in fact, it kind of looked like the old BC Ferries dogwood logo thing that we had here.
So good for the Ford government for changing the branding?
I really have no... Well, the license plate thing's ridiculous, yeah. So bad on them for that. And I'm honestly indifferent on whether to keep the hot tub logo or not.
I think if you're going to keep the hot tub logo, you just have to lean into it. Yeah, have some throw some beers on there. Buck a beer.
change the license plate to yours to Chilatsin.
Oh, and finally, just to end on a slightly different note, we wanted to note that BC's Conflict of Interest Commissioner, Paul Fraser, died this past week. He was 78, which I found actually surprising to read that he was still in his position at that age. And it seems pretty sad because every politician who spoke really highly respected Paul Fraser and had lots of nice things to say about him. I think a lot of people are saying he's the first public servant to die in office in British Columbia's history, which that's not a nice record to have. I mean, no one should be dying at their job. It's inevitable, obviously, but...
I mean, yeah, I think we've probably had a few premiers die in office. I know we've definitely had prime ministers.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it is unfortunate.
Yeah, it opens the space for a new conflict of interest commissioner, which I guess the NDP will appoint. Interestingly, the act creating this office didn't envision the commissioner ever dying.
Yeah, it's an interesting oversight.
But I guess they'll figure it out because no one in the legislature is really like going to be partisan bickering over the process, because the process is pretty well established for every other case. You get a special committee of all party MLAs together. They agree a new appointment and bring them in. But anyway, sorry for the loss to the family of Paul Fraser and to the legislature as a whole.
And that has been Politos. Find links to everything we talked about at politos.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politos. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Sersa Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.